Is your outsourced development team dropping the ball? Maybe you've worked with a team that just couldn't grasp your vision and needed constant oversight because they weren't thinking strategically. Or maybe you ended up wasting hours micromanaging, often needing to jump on late night calls across massive time zone differences to get alignment. And in the end, they delivered a sluggish app with a frustrating UI that didn't come close to the solution you had envisioned. If any of that sounds familiar, you need to reach out to our sponsor, DevSquad. DevSquad provides an entire development team packed with top talent from Latin America. Your elite squad will include between 2 to 6 full-stack developers, a technical product manager, plus specialists in product strategy, UI UX design, DevOps, and QA, all working together to make your SaaS product a success. You can ramp up an entire product team fast in your time zone, and it rates 75% cheaper than a comparable US-based team. And with DevSquad, you pay month-to-month with no long-term contracts. Get the committed, responsive development team that your business deserves. Visit devsquad.com/startups and get 10% off for the first 3 months of your engagement. That's devsquad.com/startups. Welcome back to Startups for the Rest of Us. I'm your host, Rob Walling. In this episode, I sit down with Derek Reimer and we tackle, I think it's like 6 or 7, maybe even 8 questions that were submitted on Twitter. When I let folks know Derek and I were going to be having a conversation, got some really interesting questions from listeners just like yourself. Questions about how Derek validated or whether he validated his idea for SavvyCal, the most painful feature he's built for SavvyCal, how his redesign worked out, what it's like to have an open source competitor raise a bunch of money and compete with him. And the key question you're all wondering, is Derek looking to get on a regular weekly podcast again at some point in the future? Stick around to the end to find the answer to that. And with that, let's dive into my conversation with Derek. Derek Reimer, it's great to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure to be on the mics with you.
Little do people know, you are founder of SavvyCal and author of the upcoming book, I'm Obsessed with Kerning.
That's a good one.
The reason few people know that is because you're not working on the book, but you are in fact obsessed with kerning. I had never heard the word kerning before I met you.
Really? Yeah. I've always had a thing for fonts. I don't know why. That was like one of my childhood obsessions with my computer was like exploring the world of fonts. Maybe in another life I could be a font designer.
Yeah. Oh, I could see it. In this life.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
If you exit SavvyCal for $50 million, you're just on the beach designing fonts. I feel like you might have been called a nerd when you were younger, huh?
Maybe a few times. Yeah.
A few times when you were obsessing about fonts. That's great.
Fonts, accounting software.
Yeah. Doing things in Photoshop that may or may not have a statute of limitations on them, meaning trying to replicate currency.
Yep.
What was that? We won't talk about that. It was a hypothetical. So I was going to have you on the show and I had 3 or 4 topics I thought we could cover. And I was like, you know, I might want 1 or 2 more. So I go to Twitter. I mentioned that you're coming on the show and just inundated in the best way with really good questions, topics, suggestions from a swath of people. So that's what we're going to do. We booted all my topics. Those will go into some other, I don't know, maybe I'll talk about them in the future. Or maybe we'll do them next time or whatever. But I want to dive right in. It won't be a lightning round per se, but we probably do have, 8, 10, 12 things, not necessarily topics, questions to dive through. So our first one is from KP on Twitter. And we just met KP at MicroConf in Atlanta. He is the host of the Build in Public podcast. And his question for you is, what's the most painful feature that you've built for SavvyCal? Pain as in which took longer and felt harder than you imagined.
I think we actually just built this feature and it launched this past month called Group Scheduling Mode. So this is a feature that allows you to basically specify a link that allows multiple people to book the same time slot. So think of like a webinar or a group coaching call. And it seems simple on the surface because it's just a setting, you know, like what's the maximum number of people you want to allow to book this? But under the covers, it basically touches almost every part of the scheduling infrastructure because we have so many places where we assume that only one person can be on a calendar event at a time booked through SavvyCal, I guess. Like, obviously, you can have calendar events with multiple people on them. But generally, the product assumed that when a booking occurs through SavvyCal, once that booking is in place, that time slot is blocked and not available for others to hop onto. And then, so adding this meant, okay, so someone can book a time slot, and then if another person picks that and it hasn't reached the limit yet, then they basically hop on to the calendar event, which is kind of a separate action. We need to notify in a different way about that. And then if that person decides to reschedule, well, now we need to like remove them from that event and spin up a new event if it doesn't exist already. But if they reschedule from an existing time slot to another time slot that already has a person attending, then we're like doing this lateral translation move of moving this attendee from one existing event to another. And so you can see all the permutations that this takes. And ultimately, I feel like we're in a better place. We had to like refactor a bunch of the guts of the scheduling infrastructure to kind of pass around change events, I guess you could say. Like one type of change is when an event is scheduled. Another is when an attendee is added or an attendee rescheduled. So we kind of formalized the underlying infrastructure for this, which will set us up for being able to build integrations easier. So like, I'm happy that a lot of the work is kind of not just for this feature, but boy, it ended up a lot gnarlier than we anticipated at the outset.
So when you quoted your manager an estimate of 2 days to complete it, how quickly did you realize, uh-oh, this is going to be a problem?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I ran into a few of those, the iceberg problem of getting in and discovering. That's the beauty, honestly, dude. So, you know, I used to be a consultant. I was a contractor, and we would give estimates, and it's like, we bill $150 an hour. I think it's going to take probably 16 hours, I might say, right? Or however many. And it's like, all right. So the client's like, all right, 16 hours. Sometimes you get 6 hours into that 16 hours and you realize, oh no, this is an 80-hour project. And you have to go back to them and say, look, we either don't do this and we just lose the six or we move forward. And it got even worse on big projects, right? When you're like, oh, it's like you estimate all these web pages or, you know, whatever, and you estimate 400, 500, 600 hours. And then you get in and you realize, whoa, I was off by 10, 20%. So that's the beauty of being an entrepreneur, is that you're able to make that call, and you could have just pulled the plug. You could have gotten 3 days in and been like, you know what, this is not worth it, and just killed it. But I'm guessing you did that calculus and you were like, no, it's worth doing for all the reasons you just said. And you kept moving forward.
Yeah, there were definitely a few points where, because I never want to fall victim to the sunk cost fallacy if at all possible. So even like a month in, kind of stepping back, and like Taylor and I are talking about this daily as the project is going on, and we're talking about different snags and roadblocks that we're running into and things that we know are going to expand the scope. And we would kind of regularly check in, like, is this still worth it? Do we still want to do this? And I think it was only because there were kind of, we could see the follow-on benefits and the way that it makes the infrastructure better, not just for this feature, that kept us going, because, you know, otherwise may have just pulled the plug and said, like, sorry, you can't do that kind of thing with SavvyCal, which are, you know, sometimes you have to make those kinds of hard calls. But in this case, this one's been requested basically from day one, and we have a huge long list of people who wanted it. So it was kind of like, yeah, if at all possible, we should probably add this.
Are there any other calendaring apps, scheduling links that do that? Because it seems like that would be not for mere mortals, you know?
Yeah, you know, I was actually kind of surprised. Calendly does it, and it's implemented similarly, I think. And we, you know, in as part of our research on like what might users be expecting, I mean, we took a hard look at how Calendly's handling some of these changes, and like what happens when the last person on a group event reschedules. Does the event just disappear? And so we kind of learned about like, and saw that all the ways that they, all the edge cases they had to think through, we kind of teased them out in our testing, and were able to get a good sense for like, okay, I think they had to solve a lot of these hard problems too. Like, we're not just overcomplicating this thing. But yeah, as far as the others, I'm not sure. I think, yeah, definitely anyone else who has it has had to go through a lot of pain.
So thanks for that question, KP. Next question comes from Mark Gadalamaria, and he asks, at what point would you think it's time to give up on a SaaS idea and move on? You and I have both each killed SaaS ideas. We've started things that we didn't see through. We've started things that we did see through. So why don't you weigh in first with your criteria of when it is you throw in the towel?
Yeah, this is it's a hard question, because it's so dependent on so many factors, right? And part of it is like, How much energy do you have for something to keep kind of working on it? Like, are you a Matt Wensing type where you're kind of relentless and you keep pivoting and working off the same core, but trying to find the right market? I have a lot of respect for entrepreneurs who have the grit to do that and the resources and the capability and all that. But these days, like, I try to think about the reasons why I would bail on an idea. So like, you know, if there's not enough demand, or people just don't seem to be problem aware, or if I find like there's not really willingness to pay, or maybe there's some huge platform risk things or external factors like that, or like I can't seem to find viable distribution channels. These are all reasons that would cause me to really pause and reevaluate. So I kind of think then in reverse, like, how can I get confidence that these things aren't true as early as possible? And so generally, like, if the answer is I don't know, then I would try to like think through how to get an answer to those. And you're not going to know with 100% certainty in most cases. You know, you can't talk to the entire market unless you have a market of, you know, three people or something, but try to like gain some degree of confidence on knowing that there actually is demand and that people are aware of the problem and they're searching for it and they are willing to pay and all those things.
Right. And what you're saying is that could be summarized as like validation. You know, you could say, oh, that we bucket that all into validation. I hear some people say, oh yeah, validation doesn't work, or oh, validation doesn't work the way it used to, or I don't believe in validation or whatever. It's like, it does exist. It's a thing. It's not 100%. But what you're saying is it's learning, it's research, it's conversations. It's like, if I came up with a brand new idea and I told it to you and five other people, I would at least get some feedback, positive or negative. And then I would want to dig in. And as you said, look at search query volume. There's a bunch of stuff. We don't have to go into what validation is, but I still today believe there's no formula for validation. There's no like, oh, do this and then you're 20%. And then if you get 10 yeses, then you're 50. It's like, there's no exact number, but it is, there's this directional correctness and this founder gut. It's incomplete information. And that's what you have to make a hard decision is, do I keep going? But I'm totally on board with that.
Yeah. With Level, which I think a lot of folks probably have heard me talk about this, wrote a blog post about it back in 2018 when I shut down that startup attempt. And that one I found, like, contrary to what I expected, or I just didn't anticipate this, that the people who were most excited about it and were giving me all the positive signals were sort of downstream users of the product, and they weren't the actual like people responsible for buying it. So like a lot of, you know, makers in an organization really disliked Slack and wanted something that was calmer, but the people who were charged with buying it were more of the in the manager tier of the company, and they loved it. They loved the ability to ping an engineer anytime and get an answer quickly. So they just didn't, there was a disconnect on recognizing the actual core problem that I was trying to solve, and it was going to require more of a cultural shift for a lot of the people that I thought would be good customers, for their organizations to actually buy into the premise, was a whole different animal. And to me, it just deemed too difficult, too risky. And I've since watched others try to run a similar playbook and grow really, really slowly, because there's just so much headwind there. So that was just kind of one anecdote from my experience.
Yeah. And look, it could be a matter of, if you'd raised $500,000 and spent years more working on it, maybe eventually it would work. You have to make the calculus at some point. You don't know. The timing, I think, of Slack being unseated is probably coming. I think like more and more people I'm hearing really don't like it. I don't know if that's still a real thing though. Like, if you built Level today, would you get any more traction? I don't know. You got to make the decision and move on. I say a lot that funded companies go out of business or fail when they run out of money, and bootstrap companies fail when the founder runs out of motivation. And so that's usually how I think about it, is when if to summarize it in like colloquially, it's like when I run out of ideas, when I have no more ideas or no motivation to keep going. And it's when I say I mean, I would come to you, I would go to Ruben, I would go to Einar, I'd go to like all Craig Hewitt, I'd go to all the smart people I know if today I was trying to grow something and it wasn't growing. And I'd say, here's the situation. What's your thinking? What should I try? Someone might be like, oh, you know what? I saw this other product do this thing. And if you had an API layer, whatever, there might be ideas. And as long as there were ideas on the table that I thought were viable, much like back in the days of Drip, where it's like, we're not growing, man, we are plateaued. But like ideas kept coming in of like, ooh, you could build automations. Oh, you could build a shopping cart. You could build affiliate management. All these ideas. And we just had to figure out like, which one or ones do you pick? So I think that's probably my thing. Now, the hard part is, if you're young or you're new to all of this, you don't have many ideas. And so do you just quit? Do you just launch and then quit because you have no ideas? No, I think you get better at coming up with ideas. You learn from folks that are ahead of you. You learn from this podcast and the guests on this podcast like yourself. And you read the books in our space. There's a lot of them. You, whatever it is, podcasts, there's YouTube there. You know, however you're going to learn about this so that you start to get a sense of what would Derek Reimer do in this situation? How could I channel Derek Reimer? Maybe I train an AI bot on, you know, all of your podcast episodes and try to talk to it. I know a bunch of people that have done that with Startups for the Rest of Us. And I actually think that's an interesting idea of like, just come up with thoughts and ideas and then figure out, are these viable? Do I want to do them? Because at a certain point, you have viable ideas in front of you and you're like, I'm so tired of working on this. I just don't have the motivation. And at that point, you get to then take a beat because you don't want to make an impulsive decision and shut it down overnight. But you get to take a beat, and whether a beat is a day, a week, a month, and take a breath and say, am I getting used to the idea of not working on this anymore? And kind of let that sink in. So that's probably I feel like I could write a whole book chapter on this, but that's like as about as succinct as I can get it to when I give up on something or shut down an effort.
Yeah. I'm seeing more and more people kind of pulling the line of like, nobody really knows what they're doing. This is all kind of luck anyways. So you just launch a bunch of stuff, right? And it's like...
kills yeah, me. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess like, that is a way you could do it. So you could start something and then not really pursue a bunch of ideas on how to actually grow it, and then just kind of let it sit and wait and see if something hits kind of randomly. But I think the whole...
The roulette approach. The lottery ticket approach to building a bootstrap startup, right?
And I think there always is a certain amount of like timing and luck that has to get woven in as you're like systematically trying to get traction for something. Like, we're not 100% responsible for all of our traction. There's always going to be a little bit of the timing. And honestly, like, hopefully it correlates with you identifying a problem that maybe the market needs. So you kind of intuited that there was an opportunity here, you know, which increases your odds of getting lucky, I guess, with the timing. But yeah, I would say like, for me, I've always been of the mind that like, if I'm going to work on something, I want to really focus on it and give it the best shot at succeeding. And if that's not happening, I mean, I think it's really hard to set a SaaS on the side and just wait for it to take off. Like, because SaaSes are not really, you can't autopilot a SaaS. I haven't really seen it happen with much success. So like, for me, it just is not worth the effort of trying to keep something running kind of on the back burner, but not really investing effort into it. So if I was up against that, like, do I put this on the side and wait for it to magically start growing, or do I just throw my effort behind something else? I would be more apt to just throw my effort behind something else.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of it. This is always hard, especially when it's a gut feel and it's kind of have to ask yourself questions and it's different for different people. But I think knowing yourself is another part of it, of like, do I give up on things too early? Do I not push on them? Then I should probably stick with this for longer. But am I the person that stays with the same idea for 6 years when it still has 4 customers? Well, then you should probably not do that again. You know, there's also that kind of personality factor. So appreciate the question. Next question comes from Kartik Manjunath. And he asks, how do you find customers in a crowded market when SavvyCal is competing against the likes of Calendly? And that's not only a crowded market, but it's like there is a 900-pound gorilla as well. Not all crowded markets have a 900-pound gorilla, and not all 900-pound gorilla markets are crowded. Sometimes there's one big player and there aren't much competition, but you are in one of those spaces that has both. So how does one get customers, Mr. Reimer?
Yeah, as I was thinking about this question, I was trying to figure out if it's really much different in a quote unquote crowded market than a not crowded market. Cause I mean, fundamentally it's the same. You got to show up in front of prospects who have some purchase intent, some demand, and then you have to present them with positioning and a message that resonates with what they care about. Right. So, you know, when I think about how SavvyCal, how we position ourselves against Calendly, I mean, obviously it would be very tough to just like copy their H1 and lead with the exact same messaging. You know, that's a recipe for failure right there. So I think it's like figuring out how to really authentically identify some traits or some qualities about what you're offering that is meaningfully different. And then I think it's a lot of blocking and tackling on like trying to, you know, run the playbooks so that you do show up in the places where people are looking for things. So that's like trying to get listed in the listicles where like if someone searches scheduling software and they see a bunch of articles that are showing, you know, a top 10 lists, like Can you get in those articles? Can you get in the Zapier blog when they're talking about automating scheduling? Can you, you know, there's a bunch of these things that take time and effort and varying degrees of success, but like basically trying to get in the conversation as much as possible is kind of how I think about it. And I think for SavvyCal too, there are some things that are to our advantage, like the inherent virality of the product is a helpful dynamic for SavvyCal, and it's not necessarily there for other products. So every time someone uses it, they're exposing our brand to the person on the other side, which I think is a pretty big lever. It's admittedly pretty difficult for us to measure because I think like a lot of times there's kind of initial touch and then maybe they book multiple times and it gets them thinking. And then whenever they're ready to purchase a scheduling tool, now SavvyCal is sort of in their mind because they've already been on the other side of it. So it's kind of hard to track like through the whole chain of touch points to attribute to virality. But I definitely know in kind of, you know, qualitatively asking customers when they sign up, how did you hear about us? A lot of people talk about, I used such and such as link. So there's things like that just help drive that exposure. But yeah, I mean, crowded markets, it is tough. Like if I search scheduling software in Google, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tools. So like you can't just rely on those head keywords and trying to rank for them. You got to get a little craftier, I guess.
Yeah, when I think about it super simply, if someone were to say one sentence, how do you do it? Because it's way more than a sentence, right? But like one sentence, I piggyback on what you said, which is you have to figure out how to be differentiated, and or you want to find what I'll call proprietary or owned traffic channels. I can't figure out their exact word for this, but I think of Ruben with Signwell, where dude is really good at SEO, like to an extreme. And if you enter any space and you can rank for those head terms, you can get a lot of traffic. And Ruben also differentiated Signwell. Like he has features that all his competitors don't, right? One or the other, though, can get you customers. You could actually have kind of a clone of the big player if you had massive, let's say you got 50,000, 100,000 uniques a month and you were top three in Google, you would grow. Not as fast as if you were also differentiated. That's why I said and or. You know, I try to do both, but you can't always do both. And to quote from page 51 of the SaaS playbook, how can I compete in a competitive market? A mature competitive market can be a total bloodbath, but it can also be a fantastic place to grow your business once you get a foothold. And then I go through, here are different ways to get a foothold. So one, compete on price. And I say competing on price is tricky, but you can get traction if you offer more than 80% of the product for half the cost. I'm kind of, you get it. It's not exact numbers, but it's there. I go through five paragraphs of that. Compete on sales model. So oftentimes incumbents in competitive markets have high-touch sales process where customers must schedule a demo and mandatory setup fees, and it's just a big pain in the ass. I don't put that in a book, but I'm ad-libbing here. So you can go in and do a self-server, a lower server, a one-call close or whatever, right? Compete on product. That's a little bit what you and I talk about, are trying to differentiate. Now, later in the book, I talk about features are temporary moats because people replicate your features, which I think you've experienced to a large extent. And then I have how to market against large competitors. How much should I worry about them? I talk about building moats and different types. Anyways, there's enough content. I'm not trying to plug the book, but like there's a reason I put that in there because it is really important. And this is not a 10-minute podcast answer. This is like a big answer of like, it's a lot of things to compete in a competitive market. But if you can do it, it's a superpower, right? Because competitive markets usually are large, and that's why they have competition. And so you can grow faster, right? And usually, I would say competitive markets are often growing quickly. That's why everyone's launching in them. So thanks for that question. Next question is from Aboma Kelly, and they ask, question for Derek, do you have any plans or desire to start podcasting again on a regular basis? Or are you officially retired?
Officially retired.
I didn't like that, no. Huh? Do you want to tell them our little secret of like how we specifically had this conversation?
Yeah. We talked about this over cocktails a couple months ago, I think. And I'm really enjoying doing episodes just like this one on this podcast. So for those who don't know, I used to do one of those kind of check-in on what you're working on every week type of podcast. It was called The Art of Product. And me and Ben Orenstein from Tuple did that for, gosh, 5-6 years. And it was both a lot of fun, helped me build a small audience and you know, a little community, but also it was a ton of work. It was taxing on me. I think for Ben, it was an easier thing. So I think it's kind of depends on your personality. But for me, it was like, I always felt this pressure to have something smart to say and like summarize well my learnings from the last week. And I just found it was kind of ended up being a little bit of an energy drain. So I think while I hear from a lot of folks that like they miss the art of product and they really enjoyed the content, in that regard, I wish I had the energy and the ability to keep that cadence going, but I don't know. I think I'm kind of done with that sort of podcasting, but I really love showing up here and answering listener questions and just talking about stuff.
Yeah. And that was, as you said, we were having cocktails and I said, well, do you just want to come on every, like, I don't know, 6-8 weeks to the show? Just kind of leave it as a standing invite. You ping me whenever. It's not like a recurring calendar invite, but just come on quite a bit as a guest. And you were like, yeah, why not? Let's try it. So that's kind of, we haven't told anybody until now, but like, that's the idea of, you know, of getting you back on the show. And it's just, they're so easy. These are easy recordings. We always have topics. Like even if I hadn't tweeted today, we would fill 35, 40 minutes of good content. So,
yeah.
So I think of it less as retiring and more of like moving to that next stage, you know, that next phase. Like when someone has a big exit, they often become what, an investor or some other thing. And you are like, you know what? I had a big exit from art of product and now I'm investing in the rest of the community. The analogy, the metaphor broke down around there. But so anyways, thanks a lot for that question. Hope it was helpful. Tiny C's own Einar Volset asks, how did it feel to get an open source competitor entering the market with $40 million in funding and that would have developers work for free to rip off, his words, rip off every innovative feature that you added?
Oh, Einar. Good question.
I love the wording of it. It's got to feel great. It feels amazing.
By the way, those are Einar's words, not mine.
But
honestly, on this topic, I guess in general, I would say like these kinds of things, like having competitors that are, you know, quite active in the market and obviously looking around at the stuff that other people are building and that includes us as a participant in the market, it really does help you to more quickly understand what your actual differentiators are, right? And I think you point this out in the SaaS playbook about how like features are not moats. Like you can't, because there's not really intellectual property protection in that way for what we're doing in the software space. Like anyone can look at an interface and say, I like that. Let's build that. And then, you know, there's no recourse. There's nothing like proprietary, so to speak, in that. So I think when you're seeing some of your key interfaces showing up in other places, like it's disheartening at first, but also like it just makes you realize like ultimately I can make my business stronger by not trying to rely so much on things that are ultimately not defensible. And so I think that's what we've been, you know, with this latest brand refresh that we did, we're trying to really sharpen our positioning a bit to really speak to, you know, why the people who come across us in the market as they're searching around for tools, like why do they choose us? Why do they like SavvyCal? And we had a lot of conversations with people about this and kind of mined through different survey data that we've run over the years and just sort of workshopped it a bit and tried to get a sense for this. And I think it's like people like SavvyCal because we're small and nimble, because they trust us to listen to customers. You know, we kind of started out in response to Calendly not really changing much over the years. And there were many, many forums where people were asking for stuff and they just sort of felt like they weren't being listened to. And so we sort of showed up as like, hey, we're a scrappy upstart looking to like talk to customers and figure out how to build the best tool possible. We're going to sweat the details. And so these are all things that we're trying to call out. And like, I think, you know, a company that's riding on a huge batch of venture capital and trying to grow as quickly as possible probably doesn't care about the same details. And so I think we can kind of call out some of that stuff. It's a little fuzzier than saying like we have this feature and they don't have this feature, but ultimately features are all kind of, I don't know. Yeah, it's not super defensible. So I guess that's how we think about it. And ultimately I think it does help us be a stronger company.
All right. We have four more questions to get through. Two are from Greg Dineo. And his first question is, how is Derek's redesign working out? The SavvyCal redesign. So for folks who don't know, you redesigned the homepage inside the app as well. It's a pretty significant one, right?
Yeah, not much in the app, although we did release, at the same time, released a refreshed link editor, kind of the core.
That's what it was.
Core editing interface in the app with a bunch of UX improvements. And yeah, kind of a refreshed marketing site, refreshed logo. It's been really well received.
Did you change your H1 as well?
Yep, H1 changed a bit.
He's changed some copy. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. Most of the copy on the homepage is different. Added a features page, so we kind of one place to kind of summarize key features, and then we're kind of gradually porting over the other pages to match the design aesthetic. But yeah, it's been really well received. I mean, people have kind of recognized the effort that we put into it to try to. We didn't want it to feel like your typical startup. Safe corporate startup, you know, blue and white landing page. You know, we wanted it to feel organic and kind of, we wanted the design to communicate similar values that we were saying in our words. And I feel like we nailed it. And I think, it's been well received. We've had our best sales month this last month that we've had in a long time. So, yeah.
Do you attribute that at least partially to the new look?
I mean, I think we made a lot of noise when launching the brand refresh and sent some emails to the list. So it's hard to say that it's attributable directly to the refresh design, but it was nice to have an excuse to go out and ship a bunch of stuff. We shipped that group scheduling feature and the refresh link editor and the brand refresh. So hoping that that's just another indicator that there's energy and momentum behind the company, which I think helps with marketing effort.
Neat. And I mean, even the homepage. So I don't see the homepage because when I go to savikel.com, I'm logged in. So I I know I can log out.
Oh yeah. You can go to /home.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I went incognito to look at it now, but just as a rule, when I go to Savikel, I never see the homepage because it has me logged in, but I did see you announce it on Twitter and then I checked it out. And I mean, the green, the fonts, the kerning, all the things that you care the most about. I mean, it looks great. Like it looks really, really solid. So yeah, I think you should be happy with it. And Greg's other question is, was there ever a consideration for launching Savikel as a vertical SaaS? And I will actually add to this, launching or narrowing focus, you know, at any time. He says, for example, a calendar scheduling link for salespeople, for lawyers, for insert any customer segment that you enjoy working with.
Yep, that's a good question. So, I mean, initially the thinking was to sort of be horizontally positioned and kind of see pick up on signals on like who's getting the most value out of this and potentially refine positioning or kind of narrow things a bit. To date, I mean, we have a very diverse set of customers, which is both good and bad, right? It's good in that like, you know, we're sort of hitting the mark on being a general purpose tool for a lot of different people. But the challenge is like we have to try to identify the commonalities between them and figure out like, should we go after one specific set or should we keep speaking to the same sort of messaging that resonated with this diverse set of customers? And I think we've kind of experimented with things here and there, but haven't gone as far as like fully updating the H1 on the homepage to speak to a specific vertical. I mean, I think in order to do that, I would want to have a strong enough hypothesis that I'd be willing to kind of exclude some of the people that maybe otherwise would have signed up. Like if they saw that this is for sales teams on the H1, someone who's not doing sales probably would choose not to sign up versus if we did. So I kind of see that as, you know, the more mature the business gets, the riskier it feels to make that kind of shift. But I think in smaller ways, we sort of experimented with like, for a couple of months, we'll spend some time building features for sales teams and we'll work on some things, some efforts to try to see, gauge how it's resonating aside from, you know, fully shifting the positioning on the homepage, if that makes sense.
You have to be pretty certain of that to make such a strategic shift, I think. And so it's one of those I would need to sit with for a very long time. I mean, there have been, I can bring up a bunch of examples. It doesn't really matter, but any big strategic shift like that, I need probably months of mulling it over and saying it out loud internally and saying, I think this is where we need to go. What do you think? And then like I sleep on it for a week and then I come back to it. I try it on again. You know, it's like one of those things of like, does this really feel right? Oftentimes I can't remember. It's been very few times where I've made a decision of that magnitude quickly and without like some pretty strong, I need some strong conviction that it's the right call. And sometimes if you don't have that, it's tough. You know, it's tough to think about doing it.
The hypothesis around that niche down needs to be as strong or stronger than the one that's currently working for the business. Like it has to overcome that, I think, for me.
Yep. And I think there's also has to be a bit of excitement, your internal excitement of like, oh, I'm really excited to work on this and I really want to dive deep into this. So thanks for those questions, Greg. Last two questions from Chris Livdahl. He asks, how did you land on the idea for Savikel among others that you decided to pursue? And did you validate the idea before launching it? And if so, how did you validate it?
So I made a couple couple of bullet points here on what my trying to capture what my initial thinking was. Because it's funny how it does shift over time, but I kind of could think back to like, what was I thinking back in 2020 when I was just starting to pursue this? And so the thinking was, Calendly doesn't seem to be innovating much these days. They've been kind of the household name, so to speak, for this type of product, but the product hasn't really shifted that much and doesn't seem like they're really listening to customers that closely. For me, it was big that like it would be a relatively quick to get an MVP to market to build a basic scheduling functionality. So I felt confident that I could start to test this with an actual product in hand pretty quickly. It's a product that has the virality built in, so that was a big selling point for me too. A lot of my existing audience uses scheduling tools, and I think about this as like, this is like kindling for the fire, right? Like I can't rely on personal audience to like sustain the entire business, but it's enough to get maybe a kernel of customers that are like really excited about it and willing to start using it and spreading the SavvyCal name and talking about it to their friends and sort of helping get the wheels moving on this thing. So that was an important thing for me since I had a small existing audience. I wanted to leverage that. And then there was kind of this hook that I picked up on. It's the power dynamic issue. So people were, I feel like every other week there was a Twitter thread where someone was opining that Calendly is rude and it's, you know, not good professional form to send a Calendly link to somebody because of the power dynamic issues. You're forcing me to do work to get on your calendar sort of thing. And it was an interesting, like it's both a people problem and I think a technology problem. Like I think the tech can help it feel a bit more collaborative so it doesn't feel as off-putting to receive, but it's also like, are you exhibiting good etiquette? But this was enough of a hook where it's like, well, what if we could build a tool that doesn't feel so awkward, you know, that feels more collaborative, feels more personal. And that sort of was the initial hook. So I think we wrote a little manifesto talking about the power dynamic and how we're going to fix it. And we're going to, you know, we had this visual booking interface and personalization and a bunch of other little details that were going to make this better. And put that on a landing page and started to gather email addresses and have, you know, conversations with potential customers and gauge interest. And I think that was kind of the extent of the validation. And then I got down to work building an MVP and within a couple of months was able to start testing it out with real users.
And to take you back even further, I believe you started even considering, you had a list of software that Calendly was on, and that list came from what did we pay for at Drip? What was all the software we paid for, right? There was GitHub and Slack and Calendly, you know, you can imagine what the stack was. And you were kind of saying, I mean, because you came over, we sat in my front room and we're talking through like, which of these can be disrupted? You'd already tried to disrupt Slack with Level and that hadn't, you know, that hadn't panned out, but we were like looking at, are you going to compete with GitHub? You know, not directly, but like, is there a thing there? Is there, you know, whatever, like we kind of went down the list and marked off like, oh, these are like bootstrappable or mostly bootstrappable businesses. And then we said, which of these has an in? Because that's the other thing. It's like, again, Stripe, probably not a bootstrappable competitor business, right? But there were some, I don't remember what they were, but it was like, oh, but people, there's this product, but people love that product. And like, there's no wedge, there's no differentiation, there's no angle. There are no people complaining about, or whatever. That was what we determined. And Calendly was one of a couple. I don't remember what they were, but there were two or three where it was like, ooh, any of these you could probably do. And you then talked to me and I said, look, I would pay for a Calendly alternative that did XYZ. And I think at the time it was like that integrated with my podcast recording suite, you know, whether it's Squadcast or Riverside or whatever, but it integrates and automatically creates a room. And it's like, I don't think Calendly is going to build that. And then you talked to other people, right? I think you talked to Wensing and you probably talked to Peter and you talked to Einar and you talked to like all these people and said, what don't you like about this? And you were trying to get that, like, how do I be different? Because again, we said, if you could have just gone and replicated Calendly, right? You're a good builder. You could have done it. It'd have been elegant and all that stuff, but that doesn't get you there. So yeah, that's, I just wanted to take people back even further. Cause by the time, you know, you had already gone through a process just to narrow down to like what space, what category. Notice you didn't start with a technology and say, what can this do? You didn't start with what new novel thing that has no category can I build, right? You were like, I really want to enter an existing category. And everything on that list was super competitive, right? There were a bunch of tools that, and there's a big leader in almost all of them. I've actually quoted that process. I have this book that I will publish it eventually. It's probably going to be next year. It's called The SaaS Launchpad. It's a precursor to the SaaS Playbook. And it's about coming up with ideas, trying to validate, pre-validate, launching, building a launch, you know, just all the early stuff that comes before that. And it's a hard book to write because it's so squishy. You can hear us, even you and I, experienced entrepreneurs, done it multiple times. It's still a very squishy process. And so to actually put it in writing is like, you need a lot of you know, well, this, it depends, this and that. But one of the chapters is about kind of coming up with ideas like this. And I have seven different approaches. And one of them is make a list of all the things that your company pays for now or that you pay for now. And I totally got this from you doing it. And others are like, hey, take a vertical SaaS and go horizontal, or a horizontal SaaS and go vertical, or you have a bad customer experience and you can improve, blah, 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 right? You can imagine the list of those seven kind of, they're not frameworks on themselves, kind of a single framework, but I think this is a super interesting way to ideate. And then the thing is how do you get to that next step? How do you not just pick it and say, oh boy, I want to be in that space, and you don't take the next step, which is, now let's research. Now let's find out what the weaknesses are. Now let's find out what people are unhappy with in this space so that I can at least have some type of wedge or angle or focus that differentiates me from the big incumbent.
Yep. And also when I was taking that list and kind of evaluating them against each other, there's all kinds of criteria I'm looking at. But one of the ones I was careful to do this time around, especially, was like, all right, I want to make sure that this has as close a fit to what my ambitions are and the way that I want to work. Because assuming that I'm going to work on this for the next, you know, several years, like, what's the founder fit element of it? And I hadn't always necessarily considered that. It was kind of like, well, we'll figure it out. I'm willing to do whatever. Let's just find a good idea. And I have this, there's a blog post. It was written in 2019, and maybe this list would be a little different now if I made the same one. But it was a helpful exercise at the time to write these things down. And part of it was like, coming off of the level experience, I can tell some of these are like a reaction to that, because I felt a little burned by some of the things that I experienced through that. But
oh yeah,
I'll just read it off real quick. I have these filters, right? And the filters were, the market must already exist, so I'm not inventing a category. MVP must be shippable within a few months. Level took a long time. I spent, I think, 9 months on it before I was able to get it in front of anyone, which was way too long. I way over engineered it. The product should not be mission critical. Like, it should be important, obviously high value, but not like something where if we have 5 minutes of downtime, we've severely impacted someone's business, like processing high volume e-commerce payments or something like that. Making a sale shouldn't require more than a few decision makers. Because with Level, it was like, oh, you have to get buy-in from the entire company. Yeah, that's not great. Native apps shouldn't be a minimum requirement. I wanted to be able to focus on web and maybe a progressive web app or something, but not have to build a mobile app. And I think this is kind of another Level thing too. Like, people wanted to be able to access messages across all platforms with native apps. And it's like, okay, well, that adds a whole ton of development time to get something minimally viable. And then lastly, the market should overlap with my existing audience, because I wanted to be able to leverage as much of my kind of unfair advantages or whatever that I had. So I wanted to use my audience as kindling and not just go into a completely foreign space where no one knows me. And those were my filters.
Derek Reimer, dropping knowledge bombs as always. It's great to have you back on the show.
Great to be back.
Folks want to keep up with you on Twitter, you are Derek Reimer. And of course, if they want to use the best scheduling link on the internet, savvycal.com.
That's it.
Thanks again to Derek for coming on the show. Thank you for listening this week and every week. If you're not following me on Twitter or X, however you refer to it, I am at Rob Walling. Let's connect. This is Rob Walling signing off from episode 718.